Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode number 304, recorded July 3rd, 2017. Brian Merchant, The One Device. Welcome to Triangulation. This is the show where we talk to some of the most interesting people in technology, writing about technology, loving technology, traveling across the world to find out what's inside of our technology. I am really excited today to talk to Brian Merchant. He is the author of the book, The One Device, The Secret History of the iPhone. He has written for The Guardian, Fast Company, Slate, and others. And this book is coming out right at the 10th anniversary of the launch of the iPhone. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you have a background in writing about climate change, and I mean, you write about science and technology in terms of environmentalism. I'm wondering how much of the book is about the history of the iPhone and what's inside of it and how it was developed, and how much of it is really about the environmental impacts of us all wanting to have so many iPhones.
Yeah, I'd say that it's more that it's sort of like wound throughout, I hope. You know, there's one chapter where I do look at the sort of the resource extraction that is necessary to make this thing possible. I try to tally up some of the, different elements. I mean, we pulverized one. I worked with a metallurgist to sort of pulverize an iPhone down to its basest elements to figure out what exactly is inside this thing. And I don't think that had been done before, at least the metallurgist didn't. And then we were able to say, okay, well, there's this much tin, there's this much gold, there's this much copper, et cetera, et cetera. And then I tried to look at the different sort of places where that was sourced from. So in that chapter, I do touch on sort of the cost or the toll of sort of the labor, the impact kind of on the different mining operations, the footprint of that stuff. And then I do have a chapter at the end sort of that's about the e-waste and about black markets and that sort of thing. Other than that, most of the book is given over to the history and development of the device itself. And of course, I sort of look at it from this wide lens view. So sometimes there are comments to be made or analysis to be made from that angle. But the bulk of the book is about the history of the device, of the, you know, the different technologies that went into it, the story at Apple, and sort of, you know, how they all kind of come together in the end. I hope that was the aim anyways.
Even at this 10th anniversary, you hear so much again and again about Steve Jobs. You know, I was a fan of Steve Jobs. I think you can see part of his picture right above your head there. But there's so many other people that you talk about in this book. That's what I wanted to spend some time talking about. I want to start with Sophie Wilson, because you can't really talk about the iPhone without talking about the ARM architecture. And Sophie was someone that I had not heard about. Can you tell us a little bit about Sophie?
Yeah, Sophie is Sophie Wilson she's just a fascinating person. And she was instrumental in sort of developing this low energy consuming architecture for a chip that we now know as ARM. And she did it with a partner and with a small crew in Britain during sort of the UK's first sort of computer boom. And it was almost an accident. It was, you know, they're probably most famous for building the BBC microcomputer when it was this company called Acorn. And this British company actually named their company Acorn so that they would come right before Apple in the phone book. And she had gone to Cambridge, she had studied mathematics, and she had joined this sort of this computer science club, which was just this, at the time, you know, hobbyists, really sort of a small, very niche sort of thing. and she had a penchant for tinkering. She had come from a family of builders, of DIY hackers, of really interesting folks, where she had kind of got her hands on these low power sort of electronics, and she really knew her way around them. So when the time came, their boss of the company, you know, was really interested in doing like a pocket organizer. But when they met for the first time, he saw that she had been tinkering with these architectures for computer boards. And he said, well, that's more interesting. And they sort of set about making computer boards. And there's a fun little BBC sort of docudrama kind of thing about this whole process, about Acorn Saga. But they won this big contract to make the BBC microcomputer. And after that, you know, they had to figure out how to become a sustainable company. And when they had made the BBC microcomputer, one of the demands was that this thing had to be cheap. It had to ship to classrooms, to households around the country, and it couldn't use that much energy because it had to sit in this plastic casing. And if it used too much energy, it would fry the casing. So they really experimented, and almost through an accident, they came up with this architecture for a chip design that used just unprecedentedly low amounts of energy, and that would become the Acorn RISC machine, the ARM processor, as we know it today. The company has gone extinct, but the architecture and the basic ideas, which of course have evolved dramatically since the 80s, but it's just this fascinating side shoot of history where this idea, this sort of serendipity, this brilliant person, Sophie Wilson, really sort of pushed history in this sort of, you know, sideways way that kind of wound back up. Now ARM, there's more ARM processors than any other kind of chip today. There's, I believe, there's more ARM than Intel. Don't quote me on that, but I believe that's where we're at.
I think it's like 95% of the smartphones are powered by ARM processors.
It's all ARM,
So, you know, Apple is famously secretive, and, you know, we'll get into how you were able to talk to some people there. But people like Sophie Wilson, they're the unsung heroes of the 70s. And is it that she wasn't talking, or is there like a wide swath of how the technology that led up to the iPhone, those people are just not really thought of today?
Yeah. And I think that's a really interesting question. And that's one that the book interrogates to a fairly thorough degree. But yeah, there's a number of reasons. One is that they're just are a lot of people that don't sort of fit the mold of the typical innovator. Sophie Wilson is this brilliant person. She's got a photographic memory. She's transgender. She isn't maybe the most sort of outspoken, kind of brash tech titan kind of archetype at the time. And I kind of wonder, I just kind of pose the question, if maybe she would have been more remembered if she did sort of fit the Steve Jobs or the Bill Gates mold just a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Who knows? The other thing is that, you know, the history of technology is this vast sort of knotty, like tangled web. And there are so many actors that are easy to sort of get swept away, or that maybe they didn't, you know, tell the most compelling story at the time. Bente Stump, this Danish multi-touch pioneer who actually built these brilliant multi-touch systems for CERN but never patented them, and his technology we know because of information requests was seen by some of the biggest companies in Silicon Valley and some of its biggest research institutions. Now, is that technology that he developed, is its fingerprints showing up in the multi-touch based iPhone today? It's really tough to say. You know, inventions are often happening simultaneously, often happening by teams around the world. Mark Lemley, the Stanford patent scholar, just does brilliant work, finds that he did a survey of how inventions happen and how they are patented. And there's almost never a lone inventor, almost never. It's always teams, usually working in tandem, usually often, you know, simultaneously. So it's really hard to say that, as he quotes, ideas get into the air, you know, and it's hard to say where exactly they come from. So I tried to sort of trace some of these like ecosystems of invention. And I tried to sort of see how they form in cases like multi-touch, in cases like the lithium ion battery, in cases like the ARM processor. And I hope I kind of was successful at least a little bit in showing how they wind up ultimately in the iPhone.
So Wayne Westerman was also someone who was a pioneer of multi-touch, and Apple wouldn't let you talk to him. So tell us how you got his story.
Well, yeah, I mean, Apple wouldn't let me talk to anybody. So I was sort of persistent, and I found other ways around it. I did track down his sister, who lives in Minnesota now, I believe, She was a little bit older than him, so she was kind of, in some ways, a mother figure in a lot of ways, because his mother had some disabilities, which did run in their family, which he himself inherited. So he had pretty severe tendonitis and hand disabilities, which is why he ended up pioneering a lot of this multi-touch technology that really does, that now you can trace this. In this case, Wayne Westerman, who was trying to write his PhD, was trying to use computers a lot back in the late 90s, really just he couldn't do it. He couldn't do it. So he had to pioneer another way. Just using keyboards was too repetitive. The strain of hitting the keys over and over really melted his hands down. Since he had this disability, so it was kind of out of necessity that he pioneered this system called Fingerworks that would allow him to sub out some of the keystrokes, sub out some of the repetition, sub out some of the things that were hurting his hand. And he came up with Fingerworks, this opaque pad that, you know, through, again, a little bit of serendipity, quite literally wound up in Apple's design labs just at the same time when a group of engineers, designers, programmers were really embarking on these experimental discussions about where they wanted to take input and sort of the interaction paradigm of computers next. And sure enough, they said, this is interesting. This Fingerworks pad that Wayne Westerman had made to alleviate finger stress wound up becoming the center of a series of investigations by the team that would ultimately create the iPhone.
And does Westerman still work at Apple, or had he signed an NDA that said he would never talk to anyone?
No, he's still at Apple, as far as I know. Yeah, he is sort of in charge of multi-touch technologies, sensor technologies. He very much sort of disappeared beneath the Apple curtain. And that, you know, it actually was very upsetting to a lot of people, because this product that he had made really was helping computer users that had RSI, repetitive strain injuries, that had tendonitis or arthritis. It was, for them, one of the only products on the market that could let them use computers the same way everyone else did. So, of course, when Apple bought the technology, after deciding that it sure enough was going to be the foundation for their next sort of product paradigm, they bought it and they shut down Fingerworks, and all of their product lines went dead. All of the help forums went dark, and a lot of people were outraged. They really thought that Apple had taken away this product that was integral to their lives. That was really interesting to see these sort of side stories that kind of aren't commonly thought of as the iPhone narrative, but that was a small, you know, it was a few thousand people, and now the iPhone's used by billions of people. But it is interesting that there are these sort of byproducts, these sort of, you know, unintended consequences. And it should be said in the same breath that the iPhone is actually great for accessibility. A lot of people who are visually impaired and hearing impaired can do a lot of really neat stuff with the iPhone. So there's trade-offs everywhere.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. But when you think of the magic of the launch of the iPhone, you know, the first time you saw someone using an iPhone and pinching and zooming and swiping, and multi-touch was really a big part of that, and that you write in the book that Westerman wasn't even invited to the iPhone launch? Was that, do you think that was something to a reason? Do you think the reason was just a mistake, or do you think that it was more like trying to keep that inventor myth that it was, everything was discovered by Steve Jobs?
My sources say that it was probably just an oversight, just a really bummer of an oversight, because they, you know, yeah, he, you know, by all counts, he's this brilliant guy, but again, one of those folks who may or may not fit the mold of like the sort of the brash, fast talking kind of, you know, makes his presence known. So, some people have told me that when he first came to Apple, he had a little, perhaps even trouble sort of getting used to the company culture, integrating, sort of getting involved in projects. So I can only really speculate as to why that was. But a number of people really did feel bad that he was left out of that moment just at the same time while, you know, Steve Jobs was on stage saying, well, Apple invented multi-touch and boy, have we patented it. Mm. What really had happened is Apple had made very important strides in multi-touch, bringing it to a glass surface, using a lot of Wayne's technology and tapping into decades of innovation that had gotten the technology to the point where they were able to do that. And then they had bought the company that had done it best and acquired its patents. So not as catchy a slogan, obviously. But it is interesting that those two events, Wayne not being there and Steve Jobs saying that, did happen. And I did want to underline what you did say earlier. You know, Steve Jobs, part of the mission of this book is it's not to take Steve Jobs down or to dismantle, you know, his legacy or anything. It's just to add to it by putting all these other voices that are oftentimes, you know, you could argue equally as important into the same room and saying, this is how we got there, is the sweat, the labor, the blood of all of these people who combined, you know, make a revolutionary product like this possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, so much is said about Steve Jobs, and, you know, I'm sure more will be said about him, more movies. And yeah, I mean, it does take a kind of mad genius to bring all of these people together into this one, you know, to make not just one, but all the many things that this products that Steve Jobs brought to market. But yeah, it would make, in my opinion, just as interesting a film to cover all of the geniuses behind the unknown, unsung geniuses.
Right? Yeah, I agree.
And so you also you write about some of the people that we have heard of. Tony Fadell, you spoke to. Scott Forstall, you didn't speak to. I'm wondering, Scott Forstall doesn't work for Apple anymore. Like, I think I'm not sure what he does. I know he was on writing plays on Broadway for a while. But any ideas why Forstall wouldn't talk to you at this point?
I don't know. You know, we actually did speak on background.
But off record.
Off record. I think it's okay for me to say that now. I think, you know, honestly, it was part of it was just that there is still that sort of legacy of secrecy that does have sort of this effect. And he did, you know, come forward and sit down with the Computer History Museum, and he's done a couple things. So, you know, part of it was just maybe the timing. He wasn't quite right. He wasn't quite ready to tell the story, or, you know, I don't know. I can't really speculate. But I will say that, you know, his sort of direct lieutenants, Henri Lamoureux, Richard Williamson, Neaton Ganatra, the people who worked with him every day, they all did come forward, sometimes for the first time. Richard and Henri had shared fascinating stories about the development that I had never heard before. And they could talk a lot about Scott and his sort of character as a leader, which many people both admired, and, you know, it was kind of shades of Steve Jobs, right? And that's the classic thing you hear about Scott Forstall's management style, is that it was also very intense, very demanding, but a lot of people really respected him too.
Mm-hmm. And so talk a little bit about the drama between Forstall and Tony Fadell and in the development of the iPhone. That's part of what's fascinating in this the book.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think it was becoming clear when it became clear at some point early on during the development when they were going to do a phone. I think that when Apple does a new product, it's Apple doesn't really, you know, do anything half speed. So it was probably clear to a lot of the executive staff and a lot of the management staff that it was going to be a big deal, that it was going to be a big undertaking, and there's going to be a lot of prestige perhaps involved that was at stake. So yeah, so Scott Forstall, who was had come to lead the Mac software group, saw this as an opportunity to sort of do something new and something interesting. So he kind of got involved with they called themselves the Next Mafia. They were a bunch of software geniuses, really, like Henri Lamoureux and Richard Williamson, which I just said, that had come over from the Next days, that had been with Steve for over a decade at that point. And they really were sort of championing this Mac OS looking sort of rich, you're basically, you have a computer in your pocket sort of approach. And Tony Fadell, meanwhile, had already proven himself very, very successful by bringing the iPod to prominence. And he had been doing portable music player stuff for a long time when he came to Apple, he really, really sort of marshaled his team and sort of brought the iPod from basically a really, really niche product to convincing Steve to do iTunes on Windows, which kind of blew it up. And he really kind of was, his star was rising really fast, and it was really high already by the time that the iPhone began development. So it was sort of, they both wanted to, you know, own the product, the project. They both wanted to work on this thing. They both wanted to own it, as the engineers kept telling me. So naturally, you know, it kind of put them at odds. And there was a point in the development process where nobody was sure whether or not they should pursue the means of trying to do a phone by doing this crazy Mac-based sort of system, a system based on Mac OS with a touchscreen. It had originally been designed to be a tablet. It had been sort of wound through the development halls at Apple, and it had wound up as this like sort of experimental project that was big. The prototypes were bulky. It had no battery life. It was kind of still miles away from realization. Or, you know, should they do a phone by adapting the iPod? Should they stick a radio in the iPod? They could use it as a stopgap, or if they could get the thing to work well enough, maybe that would be enough. Because at the time, the real fear among Apple's sort of executive class, and what ultimately kind of convinced Steve to do a phone, was the fact that the business proposition for doing a cell phone was almost becoming an imperative, because iPod was their big moneymaker, but cell phones were getting so smart that they could start storing enough MP3s to do both. And if Apple wasn't careful, you know, even if the cell phones were lame looking and not as cool as an iPod, a lot of people would probably just figure, oh, I could stick my MP3s on this phone, then I don't have to carry around two gadgets everywhere. So that's ultimately what sort of pushed Steve's hand. And he was convinced by Mike Bell, one of his executives, who wrote this lengthy email that's now kind of famous in the annals of iPhone lore, and really said, Steve, look, we got to do this. And then he had these two choices: iPod phone, shrink this crazy, exciting touchscreen-based thing. So they really tried both. And since Tony was in charge of the iPod phone and Scott was in charge of the software project, they ended up sort of being at odds, because it was kind of framed like a bake-off. And it did sort of lead to some tensions and political strife within Apple.
It's funny to think now that some people, you know, working on the iPhone were disappointed at the time, like, oh, we're only making a phone. You know, they wanted something bigger. And so did any of those people, this isn't really part of the book, but do you know, did any of those people go on to work on the iPad?
So that quote, that was mostly, so the input engineering group, and this is an interesting story that I really don't sort of touch on quite as much in the book. I do quote Brian Huppy, who was one of the pioneering hardware engineers who really prototyped the early the pre-iPhone, I guess you could call it. And his team, the input engineering group, was really, as you say, envisioning this interaction paradigm that would the user interface, the touchscreen-based stuff. They were really imagining it powering like this suite of new sort of input technologies that you'd use to interact with your desktop, with your laptop, with computers in general. So it, you know, we know now that it eventually got there. There's multi-touch on our trackpads. We have the iPad, as you say, and it is more places. But yeah, when word came, when Steve decided that they were going to use this technology to do a phone, they were all really disappointed because they thought that they were going to be pioneering this whole new sort of interaction paradigm for computing in general. And one of the sort of the, again, another sad offshoot that I don't touch on as much in the book, but once their work had kind of been integrated into these prototypes, once what would become the iPad had been sort of solidified, a lot of these guys were taken off the project, and they had to watch from afar as their work sort of became the basis for the iPhone and then the iPad. And actually, a couple of them got kind of fed up and quit. Josh Strickon, for instance, was one of this brilliant MIT-trained jack of all trades, software, hardware, sensor guru, really a smart guy. He was only there for just under 2 years, and he did a lot of the prototyping stuff with Brian that would become the hardware prototype for the iPad and then the iPhone. And he was just like, you know what, they're never going to do anything with this. I'm tired of these committees. I'm tired of the marketing department telling me that it's got to be this way or it's got to be that way. And he was convinced that it would never go anywhere. So he left the company before the iPhone even really began development in earnest. And I think Brian Huppy left the company shortly after that as well. So it's interesting how it was kind of taken from this core group, and you know, it just that's what happens in bigger companies. Even though Apple wasn't the size it was today, it gets routed through different departments, different sectors, and yeah, they kind of had to watch their baby grow up without them.
I wonder if there's still that struggle going on today. I know as they see, you know, Windows and Android there's one operating system. There's one Windows for, you know, any kind of tablet or computer, and Android, again, like a Chromebook is the same on a Android phone. But Apple's really stuck to this. We have the Mac OS and we have the iOS. And I wonder if there's still that struggle going on inside Apple where people really just think, you know, there's iOS should be more like the Mac, and there are people that think Mac OS should be more like iOS.
Yeah, I'm sure there is. If anything, the feedback I've gotten from people, I should mention that I did manage to interview a significant number of people who are still at Apple. So just, you know, anonymously and on background, so I couldn't quote them for the most part, most of them, but some of them I could. And yeah, a lot of them say that that's one of the things that's changed is that, you know, they're sort of the vectors for decision making and, you know, moving things up the ladder have gotten a little bit muddied. It's a much bigger company now. The decision making process has a lot more steps, you know, and even Tim Cook doesn't quite have the clout that Steve Jobs had. Even though he's CEO, he doesn't have the power to kind of snap his fingers and make something happen, or at least he's more cautious about that prospect. So a lot of ideas, a lot of, you know, counter ideas kind of don't have avenues towards realization. And yeah, and I think there's some frustration over that. You know, the flip side, of course, is that Apple is able to do things at much greater scale. It's just it's become a much, you know, bigger powerhouse in sort of producing, you know, features and just sheer numbers of the stuff. So it's a trade-off.
You brought up Tim Cook. So you write that he never replied to any of your very thoughtful emails that you sent him. And I assume there were many. Did you, when you were thinking about writing the book, did you ever think that Apple was going to let you in at any point? Or did you always imagine that this was a book that you were going to have to write by just brute force research?
Yeah. Well, let's say that I just assumed that I would have to do it that way. I just assumed that I would have to do, I love that. I love that term, by the way, brute force research. I guess that's what you have to do when it comes to Apple a lot of times. But so I did, you know, I did reach out very early on and I did make it extremely transparent what I was trying to do. I gave them detailed outlines. And, you know, in the beginning, I was actually surprised by the reaction. I was like, you know what? Maybe Apple's going to come around. Maybe they're going to, you know, have a change of heart, because they were telling me things like, this is a different company than it was even just a couple years ago. You know, we're trying, they would say things like, we're trying to open up. You know, they had me into Cupertino, into the headquarters. We sat right behind Infinite Loop 2, where most of the iPhone development took place. And I spoke to a very nice PR representative who, you know, sort of, I think we, you know, he was feeling me out, and we, you know, continued this conversation over the course of the entire year that I was doing it. They had lists, they were looking at people that maybe they could make available for interview, blah. But I don't, you know, I think they just decided that it was more in their interest to just to stay shut, to stay quiet, so that, you know, they could, I don't know. I don't know. It's really hard to speculate. It really does, in hindsight, feel like they maybe were leading me on a little bit, or, and they never really had any intention of doing anything. And just kind of wanted to keep me in good graces for the time. But, you know, that's their prerogative. I wasn't sitting around waiting to see if I could get an interview with Phil Schiller to, you know, to complete the book. I really think that history is best told by the people who were there at the time in the trenches, you know, making this thing happen. And fortunately, I was able to speak to dozens of those people, which is a significant portion of the key players of the iPhone project. So fortunately, I was able to do it. Would I have liked or been interested in hearing current day Apple's perspective? Absolutely. I would have loved to include that. But such as it is, they decided not to cooperate. So I ended up with what I got, and I'm happy with it.
Well, I mean, your book's been reviewed in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Guardian and so many places. And one thing that I haven't read, about the book is that you're not a gadget guy. Like, you haven't been reviewing Apple products forever, which in some ways makes you a very different kind of Apple writer. I think Apple journalists it's hard because if you're an Apple journalist, you love Apple products and you want to try all the Apple products. And so it's a weird kind of awkward relationship that a lot of them have with Apple. I mean, at Twit, like, they never send us review units. Leo's kind of persona non grata there. And, you know, there's a backstory to that. But it also makes us be able to, when we write about a gadget, it's like, they didn't send us this. We didn't have to get in their good graces in order to, you know, for them to send it. And I'm not saying anything against anyone who gets Apple review units, but you're not one of those guys. You're not one of those Apple journalists that has to be careful about what you say, or else you're not going to get the new iPad when it comes out. And right. So I think that this makes this a very different piece. And I know that you... there's been some controversy over some of the things that Tony Fadell says. Maybe he's walked back some things. I know John Gruber wrote on his Undaring Fireball that your portrayal of Phil Schiller was a little different than how he knows Phil Schiller. And he is someone that, you know, when you talk about opening up, like, John Gruber, you know, gets to interview those people. So what do you want to say about that controversy that's like the mini hurricane that's stirring about that?
Yeah, well, I think that, I think first I want to touch on what you were saying, because I think that that's absolutely right. And again, it isn't anything against any of the journalists who get review copies and that sort of thing, because that's, you know, that's one that's one form of tech journalism, right? Staying abreast of all the products and reviewing the latest sort of offerings and being able to offer consumers good advice about what to buy and what not to buy and that sort of thing. That said, I do think that what Apple has managed to do in being able to sort of determine who gets access to its executives, who gets access to its products, its events, its everything, you know, it's even its basic sort of unveiling events, which are very widely attended, are invite only. So there is the sense, as you said, that you do sort of have to be aware a little bit or be sort of cautious of how, you know, you publicly speak about Apple. And that's something that, you know, I go so far at some points as to considering it almost sort of a business innovation. It's something that it started to do when Steve Jobs came back to Apple in the late 90s, and he really kind of doubled down on sort of secrecy and of sort of being the lone voice that speaks out for Apple at that time. And sort of he really, really made that an imperative. And I think Brent's book, Becoming Steve Jobs, really brought that to light in a series of interviews. You know, he kind of asked him, like, you know, why won't you let anybody else speak about your products? And his answer was, one, I don't want the industry to know who these great innovators are so they can't steal them from me. And two, I tell the story best. And he was kind of aware that having a lone voice, that he was aware that he's a very good pitch man, a very good marketing force. So he kind of was aware that the simplicity, just like an Apple product, was better if there was sort of one story about it. This is what it does. Everybody quotes him. And that's also kind of what ends up happening when people conflate him as sort of the lone force behind the iPhone. So that sort of, you know, that sort of position that Apple enjoys as this sort of almost mythic force in the industry and that very few people can have access to sort of creates this unique, this unique perch that other companies are trying to emulate now. So it's a real sort of issue in tech journalism where you have your tech journalist who does have the relationship with the PR people who gets the product, and then maybe you have your labor reporter who looks at, you know, the Amazon story about how, you know, working conditions there are, or you have an investigative reporter who looks at sort of any of the business dealings. So it's really kind of bifurcated the approach to reporting on these companies. And a lot of times these sort of friendly voices, people that who have cultivated those relationships, do get access to the executives, and few others do. In terms of the flare up, yeah, I think I pretty much I went on the Verge cast and talked about this too. But yeah, I mean, I was fascinated to see this happen because, as you say, I wasn't a trafficker of Apple blogs. I wasn't aware of how fast sort of these controversies get structured and promulgated. But yeah, I mean, I have this very in-depth story that Tony Fadell told me on the record, on audio, and I have, you know, a transcription that I shared with him, and yeah, I had no reason to believe that this story wasn't true, especially because I have other sources, even beyond Brett, who gave me the second part of that story, which sort of colors the rest of it and perhaps made it more controversial. But I do have other sources who did tell me that. That Phil was against multi-touch. So I used Tony's quotes, which were taken from the record, which were very much recorded and very much told to me. And I really had no reason not to believe this. It fit with the number of other details that had been reported. And it was in line with, you know, the rest of the stories that Tony and others had told me.
I you know, it is funny how fast the blogs, the Apple blogs move.
Yeah, I know. After we published the excerpt on The Verge, which is when the little controversy erupted, you know, I was like, I told Neil, I was like, wow, this is crazy. He's like, oh, I saw this train coming from a mile away.
Well, I want to talk about your time at DEF CON. I have to say that I nobody likes to hear about anyone's dreams, but before I read your book, I had this nightmare that I brought my iPhone to DEF CON and everyone was laughing at me. And, you know, I called it the equivalent of like going to school without your clothes on. But you brought your an iPhone to DEF CON. Tell us what happened there.
Yeah. Well, not only did I bring my iPhone to DEF CON, but I logged on to like the public Wi-Fi, which is like 101 do not do. Like, it's almost like I feel like it's almost like a joke that the conference like administrators make just by setting it up. Let's see who even bothers to do this. Oh, it's that noob over there. So yeah, I did. I like joined the public Wi-Fi, and sure enough, my iPhone just got hacked. I got pineappled, as I later learned, which are everywhere there. You can just buy them there. Pineapple, the company. It's this, you know, it basically intercepts the signal, and it's a phony signal. It emulates the Wi-Fi signal. So then when you log on to it, you know, they can sort of intercept your traffic, and the people who are using that pineapple can then, you know, they call it sniffing your traffic, and they can watch what you're doing. They can collect information about, you know, where you're going, and they can even maybe, you know, if they're diligent enough, they can pretty easily, you know, do some social engineering and figure out your passwords and stuff. So fortunately, I got off in time and I updated the phone and everything, and never got any malware as a result of it or anything. But yeah, it was a very telling story, kind of, I think, indicative of sort of some of the threats that we have yet to see kind of come to the fore with the iPhone in a lot of ways, because a lot of us just think of it as this secure device, and, you know, computers get hacked, and you know, Windows computers get hacked, and so far Apple and the iPhone has been fairly insulated from that, but we're starting to see more of it, and we're only going to see more as time goes on.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that we don't really talk about a lot. Like, the fact that there hasn't been a lot of, you know, malware on iPhones is something to celebrate, I think. Yeah. But yeah, you should make t-shirts to say, I brought my iPhone to DEF CON and survived.
Yeah, I should. I should get that printed. That'd be a nice one.
So you don't talk a lot about Android in the book, which, I mean, 80% of the smartphones out there are running Android at this point. And I feel like Android had a lot of influence on innovation. So maybe it was innovation post what the history of your book talks about. But was there a conscious decision really not to talk too much about the development of Android?
Yeah. Mostly because the book was already getting way out of control. This is, believe it or not, the edited version of the book, which had about 150 more pages at one point. So it was just kind of about drawing lines and, you know, just making sort of decisions about what was going to, you know, inform the story and what was not. So I kind of made the decision to end the story when the iPhone first became the iPhone, which means I end the narrative inside Apple on launch day, more or less, and I do speak to its inventors about how they believe it's rippled out a little bit, so that's where it actually ends. And then in the outside of Apple chapters, which maybe I should make clear. So the story takes place on two tracks. There's a section that progresses from sort of the inception of this idea to use multi-touch in a computing device that would sort of blossom into the iPhone, and the story of how those Apple engineers brought it to fruition. That's told over four parts throughout the book. And then the other chapters are drilling down into the various components that make the device as we know it possible. So the concept of the smartphone and, you know, augmenting knowledge through computers, the lithium-ion battery, multi-touch, the sensors, and so on and so forth. So in those chapters, I do touch on the rise of the App Store, because I think the one major innovation that sort of finally did kick the door open for the iPhone's world dominance was the App Store. That was the final ingredient that it needed. So I had to cap it there Because this is mostly a history. It's exploring, you know, these threads and these trends and these sort of various sort of collections of people, these hidden histories. Android is a huge story, and they have sort of pushed and pulled on each other ever since the Android operating system came out and, as you said, captured 80% of the world market while making much less money for the maker of that operating system. It's a fascinating story, but it's just one. For one thing, it was kind of already told in Fred Vogelstein's great book, Dogfight, which examines the push and pull of these two giants. And two, I just had to limit the scope. Otherwise, you're going to read an 800 book about smartphones, and maybe I wouldn't be sitting here today.
Well, you know, there's also a great. It's you traveled to a lot of places: Bolivia, Chile, Kenya, China. Tell us one of your favorite travel stories for this book.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they were all great. Visiting CERN to see where multi-touch technology percolated, just a stone's throw away from where Tim Berners-Lee invented the World Wide Web with his team. That, which was a really interesting parallel that I hadn't known before. They kind of came up 10 years apart, but in the same ecosystem at CERN. These two things that the iPhone would marry together so effectively, multi-touch and the web. The fact that they were basically siblings 10 years separated was fascinating. Going to China has got to be probably the most eye-opening, because I did manage to slip inside the iconic Longhua factory and interview the workers who toil there, who actually put these things together. And, you know, it was a really, really eye-opening experience to meet and to see that firsthand, to see how far things had come since the suicide epidemics of 6 or 7 years ago. It's such an important part of the device's story, is how it gets made, how it gets manufactured, and just this reminder that there are human hands, hundreds of thousands of them, who make it possible, who perform one repetitive task and move on, and just, you know, dedicate large portions of their lives to creating these devices so we can have them in our pockets.
I mean, part of reading this book, I wanted you to solve that moral dilemma that I have, and I think so many other people have, that, you know, we love the environment, and, you know, we feel like we are, you know, human rights act, you know, advocates, and yet we also love our iPhones. And can those two be joined? You unfortunately didn't solve that moral dilemma for me. You said you saw that, you snuck out, you asked to go to the bathroom, snuck around. You said it didn't look like there were any workers there that were younger than 16, but you write that there was still a different kind of ugliness. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So in the interviews that I did with the workers, some themes kept emerging. The most striking and the most disturbing was they kept referring to this sort of ghost of death that haunts the place, this fact of life that death is normal. They say if you go to Foxconn, you just live with it. Death is normal. So it's really this new sort of culture that's there that you live with the fact that the conditions are so psychologically difficult that suicide is a fact of life. And that is largely because of the work culture. You know, it's not so much that, you know, people are blowing out their arms or breaking their, you know, or physically, you know, feeling the strain of this stuff. It's very psychological, and that starts with the management culture, which can be very cruel. That's another theme I heard over and over, that, you know, workers there who are doing 12-hour shifts, standing on their feet, doing this repetitive motions, if they screw up, you know, in any significant way, they're liable to be singled out. Their floor managers will have them stand up and publicly shamed at the end of the day and said, "This is why we didn't meet quota today. Zhu did it. It's his fault. make, you know, you will you apologize and make sure this never happens again? So it's this immense amount of pressure where you don't know a lot of people. Oftentimes you've migrated from a rural, more impoverished part of the country. You're in these giant factories, these towering monoliths of industry. It was insane how big they were, how gray, how drab, how small it made you feel, how little there was in that environment. I mean, remember, these factories house and are the workplace to hundreds of thousands of people. 500,000 people worked in Longhua at its height. And it's in one factory block, one ginormous city-state of a factory. It takes you about an hour and a half to walk across the whole thing. And there's really nothing. I didn't see any public parks or any places to sit. You saw there was a 7-Eleven where you could go spend some money and some cyber cafes where you could go spend some money. But the sum total effect was indeed this sort of grim kind of place that was designed for maximum efficiency, for production, and for little else. It was just, as one of the Foxconn workers told me, I quote, "It's not a good place for human beings," and that really just resonated, and it felt true as I walked through those factory blocks.
And for you personally, did that change the way you look at your iPhone or your use of your iPhone?
Absolutely, absolutely. Maybe it's a little cliche to say, but my phone does feel a little bit heavier now. It feels like a much more complex, much more morally complex device. And to answer or to begin to answer your earlier question, is there a moral conundrum embedded in our phones? And I'd say there is, but it's not specific to the phone. It's just as true of our televisions, of our, you know, consumer electronics, of the many, many products that are manufactured abroad, of our clothing, our textiles. The phone is just, it's something that, you know, that really sort of embodies this chasm sort of between, you know, this modernity, this beautiful sort of pinnacle of technological achievement, of sort of consumer electronic sleekness on one end, and, you know, a six-year-old miner prying lead out of the wall of a mine with a pickaxe on the other. So we really need to integrate both sort of visions of the product because they're both true. And I feel like need to do a little bit more to motivate companies like Apple that have immense sway, that have immense wealth and immense power to, you know, do more to sort of up the conditions, you know, at every step of their supply chain. You know, they can do more. We can push them to do more. We don't need to stop buying the iPhone. We do need to be more public and more sort of emphatic in our advocacy, as you say, to ensure that human rights are respected down the line of its production.
Yeah, I mean, how do we do that? Like, how? I mean, you have some background in, you know, environmental activism. I mean, how do we do that?
Well, you know, so one really, there are a number of different approaches. I think projects like Fairphone are really interesting. You know, it's this, the aim is to produce a phone where all of its components are ethically sourced and environmentally sustainable. It hasn't, you know, it's really difficult to do that. So it's really as much sort of a an awareness campaign as it is an actual product. But I'd encourage folks to look that up. But it takes getting creative. It takes sort of, you know, organizing a little bit. And it's, you know, at a time when it's really difficult to sort of muster the will to do that, when there are so many other causes going on that are worrying folks. It is complicated, but there are a number of things. There are great, you know, organizations doing work. China Labor Watch, for instance, has people on the ground. They have investigators slipping into the factories to sort of do audits and to see what the conditions are like and then publicize those findings. There's a group called SACOM. There are organizations that we can support. There are, you know, opportunities to make public our concerns, and journalists and writers and presenters can sort of do their best to tell the whole story, not just tell the story about the latest product, but oh yeah, remember how this thing actually comes out? You know, remember how this thing actually comes about? There are all of these people toiling, sometimes suffering, to make it possible. So it's a process, and I hope one that begins with understanding a more holistic view of the device that I call the One Device, mm-hmm. and that Steve called the One Device too.
And I know you spoke to the people at iFixit too. I love those guys. And that's another thing, you know, instead of, making it more repairable, making our devices more repairable so that we don't have to always replace it instead.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Those guys are, and you know, what I love about iFixit is that they're not only sort of repair geniuses, and they're not only fighting the good fight to make it, your devices more repairable, and, but they are sort of tying in that message of transparency. It's saying that, like, you know, these devices should be open. We should understand how they work, where the parts come from. You should be able to take a screw and open up your device yourself so you can investigate it yourself, so you can have your own understanding of all these parts and how they work together. So I love iFixit. I love their message. And I hope this book also sort of gets their name out there a little more, and I hope people check them out.
Mm-hmm. I have one more question. I know you dedicate the book to your child, and Steve Jobs is famous for not letting his child have an iPad, and I have three children, and the more I learn about technology, the less I want them to use it. Has writing this book made you think about the social impacts, and you know, the especially with children and giving these devices to children so early? Did it make you think any? I was going to say think different about this.
Yeah, absolutely. I think. Yeah, I'm going to answer that in two steps and anecdotally. So the first is that, so my son, who is 15 months old, we have a strict no screen policy, at least until he's two. We have a lot of friends with babies who started giving them iPads and stuff to sort of entertain and to pacify, early on, like about a year old or so. And, you know, I honestly don't have, anything against that more broadly, but I want my son to sort of, grow up with a more sort of organic, set of expectations about how people interact with each other. And we really try not only to not have him be on the screens, but not to be on the screen around him. So he's not getting, you know, just sort of inculcated into this world where everybody's staring at their hands all the time. So that's part of it. But the other part of it is when I was traveling, you know, for reporting this book, my son was 2 months old and I was in China, running around factories, interviewing workers, interviewing the people that made this stuff. And one of the great reliefs that I had is this one exception we made to that rule. And that's that I would FaceTime with him and he was able to see my face. I was able to see his, you know, and it was really important for me being away, you know, 2 weeks at a time to see him in real time and to interact with him. And I think it was for him too. And we still do that. That's the only time that he can see a screen is FaceTime, because I think that there's that sort of connection there that is remarkable. This is what the iPhone does so well that it's introduced to the world, is this sort of, it's amplified human connection in this way that is really profound. So now, I mean, it's weird, but it's just sort of the brave new, you know, frontier that we're pressing up against. And now when he sees me, like when I went on my book tour and I was in Seattle and we were FaceTiming, he sees the black rectangle with my face on it and he goes, Dada, and he tries to kiss it. He tries to kiss my face through the FaceTime screen. And yeah, it's weird. And it's like maybe not healthy, or but it is, I feel like, a reflective of where we're at now with this great push and pull of, you know, these certain things have been accelerated. Certain things have been, you know, cast aside. There's distraction and enhanced connectivity, and they're two sides of the same coin. And, you know, I really couldn't extricate myself from either of them. So, it's just something that we all have to get used to. Mm-hmm. The second part of that, and I'll end by saying, I asked this question to, I posed this question to each of the iPhone engineers and inventors themselves. that I interviewed, because I was really interested to hear what they thought of the sort of the profound impacts that their device has wrought. And without exception, they were ambivalent. You know, I'd really expected it to be more sort of clustered towards the optimistic side. Like, yeah, great, we made this world-changing product. It's fantastic. You know, it's the best-selling device of all time. You know, it's great. I loved it. Without a doubt, without exception, you know, every single one of them would go like, you know what, it's done all these great things. But then we walk into a restaurant and we see a family that finishes eating and they all pull out their devices and they're not talking to each other. You know, I walk down the street and see people just kind of like, you know, walking through a park with their face buried in a phone. And every single one of them is like, I wonder if it's done more good than ill. I think that it has. I think that it's done more good, but it's hard to see such a powerful double-edged sword unleashed upon the world was the answer that I got. And I thought that was really interesting that they all thought that too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so gray. It's not black and white at all. Yeah, I hope that it's done more good than bad. And I hope we've done more good than bad this last hour. Thank you so much, Brian. This is a great book. If you haven't gotten it, it's The One Device, The Secret History of the iPhone by Brian Merchant. It is available wherever you buy books. It's also on Audible, narrated by Tristan Morris, and on Kindle, anywhere. If you have any interest in the history of the iPhone, the untold stories, just the backstory of all the geniuses, plus some of the traveling and tracing the environmental impacts and where the inside of the iPhone comes, I definitely recommend it. Thank you so much for joining us, Brian.
Oh, well, thanks so much for having me. I had a great time.
Great. So, yeah, Brian can be found on Motherboard. I know you just posted a piece with Lorenzo, who I've interviewed before, and I always mess up his last name, so I won't even try, about jailbreaking the iPhone. That looks really interesting. I bet he had a word or two to say about you bringing the iPhone to DEF CON.
I was there with him, and yeah, he just
let you?
Yeah, well, he didn't know.
And then you can follow Brian on Twitter. It's just Brian Merchant on Twitter?
BC Merchant.
BC Merchant on Twitter. Thank you so much for joining us, Brian. Take care.
Thanks so much for having me. Bye.
Bye-bye. And thank you for joining us for Triangulation. Get Brian's book. It is fantastic. And subscribe to Triangulation. It's twit.tv/try. And Triangulation is on every Monday at 11 a.m. Pacific. And you can see me or Jason Howell or Padre or, of course, Leo Laporte, who will be doing the bulk of the interviewing still of our amazing guests. And thank you for being amazing and sticking around and watching or listening. We'll see you next time.